Future Design Podcast is made possible by the support of listeners like you. Please visit my website at fdpod.co. That's fdpod.co and sign up for my free newsletter that includes the monthly review of the latest 4 episodes, takeaways, books and articles I've read to prepare for the show. Also, if you're listening to the show on Apple Podcast, please give a rating and a review so that more people can know about this show. Now that I got that out of the way, please enjoy this week's show.
Future Design Podcast.
Ancient civilizations were said to be far more advanced in their spirituality than material technology. In our modern world, where logic and science running societal values have ran its course, shouldn't we be lifting the veil to ancient world for some answers? Hi, this is Takatoshi Shibayama, the host of the Future Design Podcast. In this episode, I have Dr. Betty Kovach, the author of Merchants of Light, The Consciousness That is Changing the World, talks to us about the long-lost wisdom of the shamanistic tradition that was repressed over millennia by church and state, and how it is a blueprint to reconstruct our societal values. Thank you, Betty, for being on our show. Welcome to the Future Design Podcast.
Thank you.
So let me ask you from the beginning, who is Betty Kovach?
Well, that's what a question. Well, I think I've been concerned all my life with the worldview that I was brought up in. That is the Western, we call it the Western worldview that's influenced the world. And that is that there's nothing but matter and we are a fluke of nature with no meaning and no purpose. And when we're dead, we're dead. And it's all over. And that disturbed me as I got old enough to be concerned about it, to know what it really meant. And so I would say that my life, if I say, who am I? I think most of my life has been concerned with the question of, is that really true? And of course, I taught in the university. So there, if you questioned it, you were not very intelligent. You know, that was the response kind of is that you, again, it was the old story of accepting what we're told. And so I questioned that, but I had to wait to get the evidence. And I wasn't a person who could believe a thing. I had to have evidence for it. And evidence in this case of experience as well as scientific evidence. So I would say that if I tried to identify myself, I think that my life has been shaped by that question and that search. And that's what I've tried to describe and explain what I have discovered in the book, Merchants of Light.
Yes, it's great. A lot of times when I ask that question, people tell me what they are and then not who they are. So I'm really grateful that you gave me this answer. So talking about the Merchant of Light, which when I read the title of the book, I thought, what is the Merchant of Light? And that's a very core of the book. And you explained it very early on in the beginning. So could you share with the listeners of what exactly Merchant of Light means?
Yes. When I first heard, I thought it was the first time I heard it. It was after our son, Pishti, was killed in a car accident. And my husband, Ishvan, and I had many visions with his consciousness after his death. And in one of the visions, my husband experienced merchants of light. And his English was his second language, and sometimes he would come up with some funny phrasing, and I thought, merchants of light? That's so strange. Later, I realized that I had read about them before, that in a Renaissance period, a time of awakening to deep spiritual knowledge of our ancestors, there were merchants of light. And it's kind of interesting because who were they? Were they people who were on the earth in time and space? Yes, I think so. But there also seemed to be merchants of light who were working in the spirit world in the other dimension and working with all of us here who want to create a much better world, a world in which we are connected to other dimensions of reality, which is our heritage.
Right. And many times over the book, there were many stages where us as humans have drawn back to where we were more spiritual, more awakened to what is divine within us. And you have come to the conclusion that, and through this book, that we have completely lost that through many times over history. And now we're facing with a lot of social problems, not just in the US, but in the world. And can you tell us a little bit about what you derived from this book?
Yes. We were always told that our ancestors were undeveloped, not nearly as smart as we are, and so on. It was tremendous misunderstanding of our ancestors. And what I discovered in going back to the cave cultures in Western Europe, about 40,000 BCE, is that, the paintings are incredible. And one can see from the paintings that they were involved in spiritual processes and spiritual experiences. And certainly these, we now know that there are such paintings all around the world. And I think the more we discover, we will see that our ancestors all around the world were in their development would naturally and did naturally want to awaken to vaster parts of who they are. They know that we have to have a consciousness to do the things in daily life, to do the practical things, but that we have another consciousness that we can trigger into altered states. And we see in the cave cultures rituals and paintings that revealed that they knew how to do that. We also now know that many of the rituals our ancestor did actually created a slow brain wave that integrated the various brain components and connected it, those components to the heart, because the heart is a brain component, which we in the West have severed from our minds. And that has caused tremendous difficulties and depression and violence and addictions, all kinds of things. But if we look back to our ancestors, we really can see that the natural modes of development continued. Yes, we have this everyday consciousness, but yes, we can trigger into an altered state and be connected with a spirit dimension. So that was a wonderful thing to find out. And even if, I had gone to France into the cave cultures. And that's what one of the things they try to tell people when they come, it's signs everywhere, trying to say, the caveman is not what existed here. Your idea of what existed isn't true. So that was one thing. But one thing that I also discovered in the research for this book is that the San Bushmen in the Kalahari Desert were very, very adept at creating altered states of consciousness. And not only that, they actually were able to go into what we could call a cosmic consciousness, which is so vast, in which one knows that we are all a part of, if we want to call it the Big Bang, when that happened, we are all it. That's who we are. We are all the universe. We are it. And thus we are all divine and we are immortal. And we are also creative. And we have forgotten those things. We've suffered so much over death because we haven't known. We just thought, you're dead, you're dead. That's what scientists told us. And to realize that was tremendous. But I was so I'm so delighted to find this out about the San Bushmen, because Western culture has so disregarded them. As a matter of fact, the government of South Africa sold licenses to go hunting them until the 1930s. And finally, they did stop that. And here now we know that these people were so intuitive and were able to communicate at distances. It is said that their heart begins to kind of thump a little bit when a communication is coming to them, almost like the telephone. And they know that if they go on a hunt, the people at home base know that they have actually killed an animal and they will bring it home. So they are preparing for that feast before they even appear. So we know that there's so many things that the mind can do that Western culture forgot and then arrogantly made it clear to one and all that there never was anything and never will be anything. And if you think so, there's something wrong with you. But so here we have the Zen Bushmen who want their method of triggering this altered state is through dancing and chanting, and they have bells on their ankles and so on. But these sounds, these repetitive sounds, can trigger a different frequency, and they learned how to do that. And there was a man, Bradford Keeney, an American, who had a vision one day while he was playing the piano. It was vast understanding and a beautiful state of cosmic consciousness, really. And of course, he didn't know what to do with it because he never talked with anybody about anything like that. And he didn't tell anybody, but it lasted all night into the next day. But since he didn't know what to do, he went to MIT and Purdue. And he did start teaching them when he finished in a university, and he was invited to go to South Africa. And it was so interesting that about a week or so before he was to leave, he had a dream in which he saw on a map, they showed him a map of exactly where he was to go and when he got there and the people he was to meet. So after he got to the university, was teaching, he got a team, he went there. And as he was crossing the Kalahari Desert, the Sand Bushmen were running toward him. And they said, "Welcome home. We have been waiting for you." And he worked with them on and off over 20 years and really made their beingness known to the world. And they trusted him so much because he could experience every state they could. And so they gave him their sacred teachings, which are now published by Bradford Keeney. So more people know about them. But I found it very interesting that he was telling them that people in the East meditate sitting alone, and they meditate alone, and they are able to achieve these high states of consciousness. And they were just alone. They just couldn't imagine it alone, because for them, it's a community thing. They touch, they hold, they dance, and they can actually trigger that frequency in another by the touch. Or, and this is really strange, they could make this energy into like little arrows or needles and throw it to someone. And when the person got it, it could kind of awaken them. So these are things that I certainly didn't know before. But I love the fact that it's a communal thing and that they want everyone to wake up, to know who we all are, you know. So that was wonderful. And I realized that this had been our heritage for thousands of years, even through the megalithic period, the megaliths all over the world. And these people knew geometry. They were considered the great builders. And they also knew that the human being is the mediator between the earth and the cosmos. And these buildings, these geometric shapes, helped us to do that. So we would be in a certain place and, of course, meditate according to the rhythms and movements of the earth and the planet, because there was nothing more important for our ancestors than to understand the laws of nature and to live in harmony with them. And so these structures were both temples and observatories. They would never have distinguish between the two, because we can experience the cosmos as a loving, creative universe. And of course, we have a part of the brain that would immediately want to understand it scientifically. So it's all integrated, you would say. So these things, I was delighted to know that I'd been told all the wrong things, and that my ancestors in so many ways were much smarter than we were, although we know things today. But I wanted to have the book so that people would read about these cultures and realize that as we develop, the natural continuation of development would be to open up to other dimensions of reality and experience this faster consciousness, because we are all universal mind. And as I think it was Aldous Huxley said, the mind has like a little valve, and sort of closes down so we can, you know, get through the day and drive our car and not kill ourselves. But if we can release that valve, then we are in our natural state of vast consciousness. And this changes everything about the way we live in the world and the way we treat each other.
Yeah, I've always questioned the understanding of our histories, even during these megalithic times, or actually, there was such a long time where we started out as, let's say, cavemen, and we were not even Homo sapiens, we were Homo erectus or Neanderthals, and there was nothing until recorded history. And that's simply something that I couldn't really understand and why. And now we have this knowledge that maybe the Sphinx was made during the Ice Age, or you're talking about 40,000 years ago. This is deeply within the Ice Age, where people were reaching this altered state of consciousness through technologies that we have not possessed anymore. And I feel that right now, because of all these things that are happening in our world, and we feel like we lost this moral principle, maybe through these secular idealistic things that we have now, and we're so detached from religion. Not that I'm saying that religion should be the moral principle or moral guiding tool for us, but because we try to distance ourselves so much away from moral ethics and become hyper-rational and thinking of everything that needs to be rational, we have drifted away completely. So how do you think that this is what triggers my curiosity a lot. And you talked about these Bushmen dancing and being in a communal state where they can feel each other and reach the cosmos as well. And how do you think these people, let's say people in the cavemen or in the megalithic sites, whether it be the pyramids or the Göbekli Tepe's or these worlds, how do they reach altered states of consciousness?
Well, we know that in the cave cultures now that they probably did use sacred plants. There's some evidence has been found of that. And of course, in cultures all around the world, sacred plants have been used. And it's an interesting thing, because when we in the West discovered the plants, like in the 60s, I was teaching also early. I'm early in my teaching. And that was a very exciting age for people, because they were discovering another dimension of themselves. But with the sacred medicine, we didn't have elders who knew the deep sacredness of these plants and how to work with them to actually create a relationship that would bring about another kind of consciousness. So we very much misunderstood them. And of course, governments have not wanted us to use them, because then we know who we are and can't be controlled. So it's very interesting always to look at what type of substances are forbidden or illegal in a culture. But people have experienced altered states for thousands of years by using various plants or drumming or ritual or dancing, whatever. And there are many people, well, maybe not many, but there are people who do have spontaneous cosmic conscious experiences. I guess we don't really know how many, but it seems to be much, certainly fewer than those who do ritual or sacred plants. And now there are many techniques I think we're developing today too that help people to do that. I think actually this should be one of the most important things that we would think about, is how do we release that valve so that we can experience the vastness of who we are and what the universe is. But basically, I think those were the ways in the past.
And there's a lot of texts, yes. And there were a lot of texts after recorded history about people using metaphors about these ways of reaching wisdom or consciousness. You talk about the Tree of Life, and you talk about the Queen, Heavenly Queen, and all these. I think there are metaphors for certain things that they don't actually use the specific word for you know, reaching altered state of consciousness. Could you tell us a little bit more about these?
The metaphors, you mean? Yes. Well, you mentioned the tree, and certainly the tree of life in the Garden of Eden, let's say, in the Judaic tradition, was really symbolic of, in taking in the fruit from that tree and experiencing who we are. Now, that could very well have been a metaphor for eating, taking sacred plants, but it also was a metaphor of taking the fruit from this tree of life and becoming that tree that is rooted deeply in the earth. Its branches go into the cosmos, and it's a wonderful metaphor for life itself. But it was used, there are many seals in Sumer, for example, of a person being led to the tree and then handed the fruit, that it was available. It was for anyone who was ready to understand a larger dimension of the meaning of life, of what life is. And there I have in the book the one seal, which I like so much. It has the tree with this fruit hanging from it, and the god and the goddess just with their hands offering it. Just like, it's like, here it is, take it. And so these are older than the Judaic tradition that most of us understood and grew up with, in which there was a tree of life, and that God told Adam and Eve, you can eat of anything in the garden, but not from that tree. Of course, as parents, we know that's exactly how to get someone to do something, but evidently God didn't know that, but or maybe he did. But at any rate, of course, Eve sees the serpent. The serpent says, no, you won't die. God told them that they would die if they ate of that fruit. And the serpent says, no, you won't. She ate of it and gave it to Adam. Well, of course, it's a horrific story. And this is what I call the inversion of a true myth. A true myth is actually a result of the organizing principles within the human psyche. It's not just, you know, it's not a sacred text because someone says it's a sacred text. It's sacred because it is organized by the principles within the human psyche that guide our evolution. If an organization such as the Deuteronomist were, want to control us, then they can invert it and say, no, you cannot do this, and that then they did do it, then you're sinful and you're damned, and things are, that which was sacred has been cursed, such as nature and childbirth. And it's a very dreadful story that we grew up with, but it is not our true myth. So that was the metaphor inverted. And it's caused a lot of damage, because even if people don't believe it, I mean, it's like, really, we don't, you know, this is not what happened, you know, but the thing of it is that the image has an imprint on us. And the Deuteronomist in Judaism around 621 BC, BCE, they emerged. No one really knows who they are, but they destroyed the first temple tradition, which was a mystical tradition. And they had techniques of experiencing altered states of consciousness. The Deuteronomists came along and destroyed that tradition. And it also nurtured the feminine dimension of the divine, which is a metaphor or a symbol for the soul. I mean, everyone has the feminine within them, just as everyone has the masculine. But the feminine was of the soul, of life-giving. And the literature associated with her was called the wisdom literature. And it has to do with who we are and how we can live our lives deeply and meaningfully and lovingly, and that we're all a part of the universe and divine, immortal, and creative. Well, that was thrown out. Now, Jews took some of that to Egypt, and it was saved. Probably others even later during the exile in Babylon worked to save it, and it re-emerged as Kabbalah in Europe much later. But it was a it was a dreadful time, really, because the tradition of how to achieve altered states of consciousness was destroyed. But the tree, going back to that metaphor, later developed in Egypt in the most exquisitely beautiful, true metaphor for our evolution, is that the tree, actually the trunk, is the feminine body. It is the woman, and she is leaning out of the tree and giving either drink or fruit to anyone who comes to the tree. And it always was her job to give the fruit because she is the tree. So it's interesting how that was distorted by the Deuteronomist. It becomes an ugly, sinful, terrible thing. Whereas really, it is the soul in us that feeds us and opens us to this larger dimension that the tree symbolizes.
And also the snake, represented in the Garden of Eden, is the one that is luring, you know, Adam and Eden to to eat the fruit. But over the course of the older history, the snake has a different meaning to it. And what was that?
Yes, it certainly does. Yes, I love that in there, that there's the snake and she is vilified. But the snake is the Kundalini energy. And it's interesting that it's that energy that sort of eggs her on to take that fruit. Well, of course, that's what the Kundalini does. I mean, if it begins to stir in us, we want to have that fruit. We want to have that experience and that consciousness. So yes, the serpent was sacred and spirit, or we'd say it was considered feminine Shakti that would rise from the base of the spine up through all of the chakras in the heart and fill the mind. But he got a bad rap, you might say. It's interesting that all religions begin with a mystical inner experience. Every religion is rooted in a real experience of cosmic love and creativity. But once an organization gets hold of it, and many of the people in the organization, of course, have never experienced this kind of consciousness, and they don't even know what is being talked about. And so they make rules and regulations and doctrines that have almost nothing to do with our evolution. And so it's really too bad, because they were actually inspired by the actual mystical experience or the persons who experienced that, but they lost it. And this happened with the Roman Church when Christianity developed, is that Jesus was a mystic and taught a hidden tradition. And that hidden tradition was how to awaken the soul to who it really is. But many in the church didn't know that. And they were very interested in control, because they wanted a church that would keep the empire together. And so there were rules and regulations, and those people who experienced altered states of consciousness were considered heretics and to be destroyed, or certainly not to be a part of the church. So the church itself was rooted in a misunderstanding and also the need to control others. And you can't control others if we know who we are.
Yeah, it's interesting how you talk about early Christianity was based in this shaman mystic traditions, and Jesus was actually talking about finding the force or the divine within. It's almost like the same like Buddha, where he was talking about find the God within you, and it's not somewhere in this universe or something. It's all in us, and we just need to learn how to find it. And I think that's quite the similarity with the early Jesus way of teaching as well. And it got destroyed by people who want to make it into an organization. The same with Buddhism as well. You just became an organization. You have to have a temple. You have to have a statue and bow to it. And I think that humans always want to have some structure to it, right? And there's no structure to finding the divine within. There's no structure to how do you find altered states of consciousness, because it's not one way to do it. And there's no one result either. And I think that's why people get misguided or they get confused, because every experience is different. And I think that's kind of how people want to control people who want to believe something. They always want to make it a standard. They want to standardize everything so that it's so easy to control. Maybe not from like a very devious kind of way, but maybe they just want to control everybody that way so that, you know, everybody has equal results in the end.
Yeah, and it's not going to be that way. I think that we all are capable of experiencing this vast cosmic consciousness, but we've lost our way. I have a feeling that the German poet Rilke had said that we've actually probably these organs that could open us to this dimension have atrophied because we haven't used them. And I really feel that that's true. I think there's nothing more important today than first of all, knowing who we are, knowing the components of the brain, and knowing that the heart is a part of the brain, and understanding how they work. The organization Heart Math it's wonderful. One can find it online. Of course, Heart Math, they've done a lot of scientific study about the various components and how to entrain those components with the heart. And people are less aggravated, less violent, more intelligent. Children who are having trouble in school and they learn from Heart Math how to entrain or breathe in a certain way, as the East is known forever, to breathe in a certain way to become coherent. So that's what our ancestors did with those rituals. We now know that with the rituals, they were learning to create this slow brainwave that would integrate the components of the brain with the heart. They didn't have that language, I'm sure. But I think that if we could know, first of all, who are we? What are these components? What is the heart? And have these experiences of how connecting to the heart changes the way we feel and how we can actually be in touch with other dimensions so that we could actually do something about it, you know, rather than talk about it. So I think there's nothing more important than understanding, first of all, who we are, and then on working on these techniques, whatever they are, techniques that will help us to integrate the brain components with the heart. And that would change the way we create civilization, the way we bring up our children. I mean, we have gone so far from that we, even though we now know through quantum physics that it isn't just matter, you know, that we know very well that there are many dimensions of reality and that spirit or consciousness is primary. That is, it comes before matter. Matter can't exist without consciousness. It is consciousness that creates the universes. And now that we know that, I think that we don't have to be tied down by this dreadful, demeaning view that there's nothing but matter and that we're nothing. That is over. That is false. And we know that now, although many people don't seem to have heard it yet. And, you know, they say it usually takes 100 years. We don't have 100 years. So, but the fact that quantum physicists know that consciousness is primary, it creates the universe. And we have everything within us to be connected to the universe. If we know these things, and would then, I think the important thing is we work on techniques of how to integrate these components with the heart and how to open ourselves to this vaster consciousness. It's absolutely necessary for our survival.
And to be able to connect with this cosmic consciousness or, you know, general consciousness in general, it's very hard for us right now because, let's say, you know, the modern neuroanatomists are amongst us as well, and they're always trying to control us, not trying to have us have an open mind. They don't want critical thinkers. They want to have people who just are sheep. They just want to follow. So how do we as modern human beings, you know, take back what we had before? Because it's so hard now that we are deep in this educational system or the overall social construct that now that you're saying that we all matter, everything is about being logical and not being intuitive and don't care about what your feelings are and spirituality in general. I mean, how do we get back to that?
Oh, good question. Good question. Well, you know, our ancestors taught us actually that the way we heal the world is by healing ourselves. So we have to start with ourselves. And I think that, you know, when we can make these heart connections, we behave differently, but we also are working on a different frequency. I think that that's the first thing. And I'm really pleased that there's so many people today who really are doing that and who are interested. They, since quantum physics especially has changed the worldview, that people are working on, a lot of people are working on it. But I think that the power of one individual is so much more than we are aware, that when one person can change, I think we do have an effect on others. And it, you know, I know from my own experiences, like having to work at it all the time, you know. But I think also that a very interesting thing is happening, that since quantum physics, for example, there's an organization in the UK called Scientific and Medical Network. And in the 70s, a group of scientists got together and they said, you know, since quantum physics, we can't play this old game anymore. We have got to include the study of consciousness. And before that was, you know, what is it? It's just an effect of the brain. I mean, it was a kind of pretty bad description of consciousness from a materialist. It just, you'd think, what is that the best you can do? You know, but they said, okay, we've got to bring science and these mystical inner experiences, consciousness together. We've got to work on this. So they did, and that organization is really still going, and it is very powerful. It's doing so many good things. In fact, one of the persons who just won the Nobel Prize for the discovery of black holes is a member of that. But they've had 6 Nobel Prize winners, and they have some of the top scientists really in the world are part of that organization, and they study consciousness. I mean, they in fact had me come and speak about this book, and they also did with my first book when I talked about the death of our son and the visions that we had. So this, when I was in high school, this would never have been imagined. You know, we just couldn't imagine it. But they are working with just incredible kinds of consciousness now in people. And so that's one organization, but there are many of them. There are others. They're kind of like an international hub now. But then I think of HeartMath, and then there are other scientists and visionaries who are coming together. So I'm hopeful that while we're struggling, trying to figure it all out, you know, and make these connections and work on ourselves, work on the darkness in ourselves, that other people are too. And I'm hopeful. And I think what we're seeing now is the shadow side of the worldview that we have had for several hundred years. I mean, having a worldview that, you know, feelings, I don't care about them, keep those to yourself, just give me the facts, and focusing on rationality, because rationality is not rational without feeling. There's some things you have to feel in order to know. But at any rate, I think that that we're moving so much away from that now, that there's some real hope for us.
Yeah, we had an episode with Peter Voss. We talked about artificial general intelligence, and what they're building is a chatbot, but fundamentally what they are hyper-rational artificial intelligence that can reason, they can do critical thinking, they can give us the right responses that we need because they are not emotional. They just give you the facts. You know, this is probably what this person is thinking, and so this is, you know, what you need to know. And then we as humans probably have to be a lot more in touch with their emotions to take that information and decide for ourselves. We can't let these artificial intelligence run us, right? We have to use them to augment us. So now that, you know, we are going into this more technological world where a lot of things, rational things, can be outsourced by these artificial intelligence, we need to be more in touch with their emotions, more our spirituality. And the works of quantum physics definitely is something that we need to learn and understand a lot more about. And also, we also had an episode with another researcher that is working with the Imperial College using psychedelics as well. So they're using ayahuasca and different things to find the ways that we can reach this altered state of consciousness as well. So I'm not really saying that we should get everybody into a bus and let's go to the Amazon and do all this together. I mean, obviously there's many ways to reach these altered state of consciousness so that we can be a bit more in line with our true selves. And what are some of the other ways that you can think of that we can break away from the existing norms that we've been tied to?
Oh, first of all, I want to say that's very important information. And here they're working in various universities too, with various kinds of sacred medicine. I am a little concerned, as I could see you are too, with artificial intelligence. We have to be, I think, very, very careful with it. I mean, I'm certainly happy for any kind of real intelligence that comes through, you know. But I think that there's some things that maybe can't even be known unless the heart is involved in it. So they couldn't really even give us all of the factual knowledge. There's certain types of factual knowledge and critical thinking that they could do, but I'm very concerned about a critical thinking that doesn't involve the heart. I can say that in my own visionary experience that I would think through things. I would be in a place where I would think through things and I couldn't arrive at a really full understanding without the heart. It just absolutely, and it was a way that with the heart, you know that this is correct. Whereas, you know, when you're in the university and you're doing critical thinking or wherever you are doing it, you have a lot of questions still. I mean, a lot of variations, a lot of questions. And it's so interesting in that larger state, which I don't know that artificial intelligence could achieve, you know, if this heart, this feeling, this deep connectedness to another dimension, is that it's like, you know, and it's like, that's what gnosis, the word gnosis meant in the ancient world, is that it's like realer than real, you know it, it's you have no question about it. So I think that I'm a little concerned, and it could be very dangerous. And I know that some people working in artificial intelligence don't know much about the metaphysical world, but I'm sure there are those who do. But I'm very worried about coming to conclusions in critical thinking without the process of the heart. We've done that for a few hundred years in our human way that's not been like artificial intelligence, but I'm just really concerned about that. And I think that, yeah, we could, it's always good to see, okay, what does that come up with, but not let it be beyond what the heart would come up with. I don't know. Am I making myself clear with that?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think these artificial general intelligence are looking at how do we be more and more rational, and without the, so I think there are two buckets, even within this artificial general intelligence, people who are working on these. One that wants to replicate humans. They want to have them to have consciousness and emotions. And how do you study the neural science behind how we think and try to develop that into a artificial intelligence? And the other ones that are thinking about how can we create the critical thinking, you know, not just like data analysis, that the type of AI that we have now, but more about how do people actually understand things and how do people actually derive at a conclusion. And they're trying to do that. So I think there are two different buckets. And the first bucket of creating consciousness and all this stuff is probably decades and decades ahead. I mean, there's no way that we can do that without really understanding who we are to begin with. So I'm more okay with the general intelligence about how to understand, trying to understand how we think so we can replicate it so that they are more rational than we are. And we as humans can work together to giving that emotional side and then also the rational side to work together and then come to a conclusion by ourselves, our human selves.
Well, in that sense, I agree with you. Yes.
So, yeah, but all these technologies, whether it's AI or not, I mean, there's so many technology right now, IoT and all these sensors, and, you know, it could all turn into more a dystopian world where it could be a surveillance state, or it could work for very well for humanity detecting, you know, pandemics before they arrive. And I think there's many applications with it. But my core belief is that if we can't evolve as humans much better than we are right now, there's no way we can handle these technologies in a better way. And if we go down this same path of this, what you write in the book is just focused on the masculinity part, was all about power and control, then obviously it will go down towards this dystopian path. So I want to derive at a conclusion where how we can become better as humans, more entwined with our spirituality, so that we can make a bit more of a utopian world than where we're heading towards right now.
Yeah, well, I like how you describe that, and that's true. I mean, we certainly would be grateful for more critical thinking, a greater ability in that. My concern is simply that we need to know who we are first, or along with it, because to usurp that when it is not known could be very, very dangerous. And I think that we have powers that we have no idea of, the powers that we do have, and the kind of thinking that we are capable of. When our whole system is functioning, we just haven't done that. But people who, I guess a few humans who've really been able to achieve that, do know, and they are capable of very profound critical thinking and feeling. So I just think we have to know what our potentials are, you know, as well.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think the ancient people who are really in touch with the universe, the cosmic universe, can say to us humans right now? Because I think they see a very different world where they thought their evolution is going to be, and how we actually arrived at this state now.
Yeah. Well, we know what they did for their own lives, so I'm sure that they would hope that we could do that too, because whatever we create as a culture, there has to be an inner kind of rootedness and base for it. And they felt that since we are all a part of the universe, that we need to be in rhythm and sync with that universe. It doesn't need to be in sync with us. We're a part of it. I mean, in a sense, you know, we sort of have that dreadful ego-centeredness that needs to be relaxed, that we are a incredibly powerful, creative, immortal part of the universe, and we need to know who we are. And in order to do that, we need to live our lives in harmony with the laws of the universe. And we have sort of come to a place where we think we can create the laws practically. We can do what we want. And that's part of our having lost that sacred knowledge, that whatever they didn't have, they did know that we, if we live in harmony with those laws, it's just like opening the doors, you know, for these abilities that we have. So I think that they would grieve to see how we have gone astray. But also, it's interesting that when I discovered all that we had been, or who our ancestors were, and that how that was lost, not only by the Deuteronomists and the Roman Church and state political structures, that certainly it was lost, but there were periods, incredible periods in history, in which that came back again, because it's natural, it's within us. So if things come together in such a way, then that is reborn again. So there were 5 Renaissance periods of our ancestors' knowledge. One was in the High Middle Ages, in which through Christianity, they actually arrived at the hidden teachings of Jesus. And that was to achieve the cosmic human being, to achieve that heart consciousness. And then it was the Italian Renaissance, which really moved away from the church and tried to help the individual to see who we can be in culture and civilization. But that could only go so far. They just were not able to open to some of these deep spiritual traditions, as such as Kabbalah and Hermeticism and Gnosticism, that kind of thing. But then it was reborn again in after the Italian Renaissance in the 1600 to 1620, I think it was, and it's called the Rosicrucian era. It wasn't even known that we had that Renaissance until the last century. It was so destroyed by the church and state. But that this was a coming together, not only of this ancient knowledge, but of course it included scientific knowledge. So here these people were mystics and scientists. But when it was destroyed by the church, later the scientific society that is in England, the Royal Society for Scientific Study, that was 1660, I think, they could only study matter because the church had condemned that. If they wanted to live, they could not go into consciousness and the depths of who they are. So it's kind of ironic that the church prevented the spiritual consciousness to develop. So that's why we had the materialistic worldview for several hundred years, because they could not. These scientists, many of them who were in that society, they had been doing their own things, you know, earlier. They knew what was going on, but they couldn't do it publicly if they wanted to live. So, but we've had these Renaissance periods. So, and today is a fifth one, you know, it is coming. And what I had started to say earlier, and somehow I pulled myself aside from it, I guess, was that this, all that we see, this horrible darkness and craziness and violence and hatred and racism that's, you know, coming up to the surface, it really, I think, is that darkness that was, that is part of the worldview that we had for so long. And so if we change, we can work on ourselves individually, but at the same time, we're doing it culturally. This has all come to the surface, and we have to really look at that darkness. And I have to say, okay, in what way am I part of that darkness? What do I contribute to it? What is a part of me? And really work on it and realize many of these people who are trying to control us and seem absolutely crazy are very damaged human beings, and emotionally and mentally. That's what our worldview has brought about in a way. So I think it's a time of really reckoning with the darkness that worldview has created. Hopefully we can see it for what it is and work through it and come out on the other side with a larger consciousness.
Yeah, I hope so too. And I think we had this small blip in our modern history, like in the 60s and 70s, as you alluded to earlier, that people were experimenting on their spirituality a little bit. You know, a lot of people were going to India and meditating, and you have this a little bit of, you know, the so-called hippie movement during the time, and I think it spread around in the world, and that got squashed as well. And how do you think this time is different? Because, you know, there are the same institutions in place, a lot of similarities, you know, still wars going on, you know, governments being more and more assertive on their authoritarianism. So, you know, what is it that we need to punch through to get out of this?
That's a good question, because certainly it has been squashed again and again and again. Every time this Renaissance period developed, it was squashed before it could really develop. So why is today different? I think, number one, quantum physics. That, you know, we have people who know, they have the knowledge, the science, the scientific perspective of other worlds, other dimensions. And then there are so many people who've had experiences like the near-death, people who've experienced near-death. Years ago, there were already 8 million that they knew. Well, there are millions of people who have had these experiences. Some of them come back with abilities they didn't have before, but they know that there are other dimensions of reality. And then other people have had dreams of being, you know, with the work of Carl Jung, he has recognized the validity of dream as the metaphors of the soul that are guiding us and leading us in our evolution, in our development. And so we don't have to dismiss them as just having eaten too much, you know, for a supper or whatever. So there's a knowledge that there is now also the visionary brain, that this is a part of the human mind, and that our first language is symbol. And the early Christians knew that. They said spirit speaks in symbol. But we now know that scientifically, that the first and earlier language is symbol. And that right brain feeds the left brain, and the left brain can convert it into rational thinking. And that's why, you know, we have to be very careful with anything that's artificial, because here it is. This is it's a deep roots in us, and that's rooted in a heart that really does connect us to the cosmos. So I think we know this now. We know about the brain. We know about the ability, and along with science, and more people are experiencing other dimensions. I think it gives me hope, and I'm so amazed with so many people who, like in all of the podcasts that I've done, you including, I mean, you are interested in these things. You're young, you're another generation coming, and you really are interested and working with these ideas. And there are many. When I was teaching in the 60s, I was also just amazed with young people. And I feel that age is kind of existing again. It was trampled down for a while, you know, and now it's coming back up. I think because of the science and the visionary experience that we just might make it. More people know about it, you know, more people throughout the world than they did in those earlier periods. It was mainly a small group of people, but there's quite a few of us, you know.
Yeah. And definitely with the kind of negative effects of technologies as well, you know, social media and such, that we are seeing really bad sides of us, you know, political divides and cancel culture and all these things that are coming up that wasn't really there with the invention of social media and such. So I think that, you know, we're seeing more and more of this dirtiness of politics, dirtiness of our human nature that's really coming out and not really being led by any guiding principle. And I think that's why we're starting to get exhausted of all this.
Exhausted and long for a principle, exactly. You know, of it. And it's so true that when we look at some of our politicians and it just looks as though they're doing things out in the open, and before, much of it was being done, but it was covered up. And I was so amazed when Bernie Sanders here in this country was running. He said things that the United States was doing that were not said publicly before. And in the 60s, students were beginning to catch on that the United States did this and did that. And of course, we always played the role of the bright and shining city on a hill, you know, and gradually they were beginning to know. But I think young people know vast amounts that people in the 60s did not know. I mean, in our country, in this country, they know what many of them know what the United States has been doing. And I think we're learning not to take the narrative, you know, that can we really believe politicians? Can we really believe the government narrative? Let's look at that carefully. Let's do some critical thinking here and get some real facts. Of course, part of the narrative is that if you question, critically think about the stories we're given, that you're a conspiracy theorist. That's part of the narrative to keep you from doing it. But I think that a lot of people are much smarter than that, you know, we see, and it's out in the open. That's what I like. Many of these things were not talked about publicly that are now, and that's a good thing. I mean, and here is our president today who is not, he does whatever he does. He's not hiding it too much, you know, and maybe we need to see it.
Yeah. And then also, you know, during the 2008, they just completely transferred the national wealth into the banks, and they openly did it. And it was the Democrats and such too. So it's not like it was just a Republican thing or the Democrat thing. It's just everybody's doing it. So I think now there's no good guys anymore. I think we all see that. And I think, you know, this is like a U.S.-centric thing, but even in within Asian societies, you know, there's so much of that rampant. So, and I think younger generations, much younger than me, are also really in tune with that, and they see it, and they just had enough. And, you know, hopefully we can continue that torch onto further generations. I mean, we don't have that much time, but, you know, hopefully we can conclude this very, very soon.
But then it's very, very important that we know when these depressions come, what is happening, what is really going on, and who caused it, and where did the money go? And you've stated that. That's very important. And I think more people do know these things, and they don't want to put up with it. But also, we have to go beyond any party. We have to go to what are the facts? What happened? Who did this? What were the repercussions? Rather than thinking in terms of party, because we'll get ourselves in big trouble.
Yeah, it's almost like strange. I mean, this is a side note, but like just having two parties within such a huge country, it's kind of strange, because there's so many different ways of thinking in different fractions within it. So, you know, why just have two parties? I mean, it's just not really the way to do it. Anyway, just don't.
Yeah, it's true. And I think back to what you said is that whatever anybody wants to call himself or herself, there are basic principles of how to live life that is beneficial for everybody on the planet. There are principles. And if a party doesn't follow those, then we're in big trouble. But I think that when we look at policy or beyond parties, when we look at what's happening, we have to ask ourselves, what are the basic principles of life on this planet for all living creatures, including human beings? That has to be our guiding light, it seems to me.
Yeah, for sure. We had another gentleman talk about uniting our world with sentientism, which is, I don't like to use ism either, but basically what he's talking about is how to be more compassionate to all sentient beings. And I think that should be our more guiding principle. And we have completely lost that, right? And then I think we can get there by talking more about the spirituality that we have within us, the divine that we have within us.
That's true. And that compassion, that love comes from the heart. But we just thought of the heart's an organ. We don't realize that it actually gives more information to the brain than the brain gives to the heart, and that it does connect us in frequencies to other dimensions. We're just beginning, I think, to understand what we might be if the heart could really open. I mean, that compassion, that love that is possible, is available, you know, that would change everything.
Yeah, well, I think that's a great way to conclude our episode. And thank you for such a wonderful conversation. And I really enjoyed it to its fullest.
Well, thank you, Taka. I did too. And I'm very delighted in what you're doing. It's wonderful.
Thank you very much. And how can people continue following or, you know, discover more about your work? I've seen YouTube channels. Obviously, you have two books out already.
Well, basically that. I mean, I think that I deal with the problem of death and the miracle of death. And it was these experiences made me know that consciousness continues. And I think that's a big thing for us in our culture. So that book and Merchants of Light, and they can be purchased at any place that sells books or eBooks. And the website is Kamlak, KAMLAK.com. So then the more information is there.
Okay. Thank you so much for your time again. And I hope to speak to you again soon.
Thank you, Taka. Good night. It's night here.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for listening all the way to the end. If you had enjoyed or disliked the show, please let me know in the comment section. I can only improve or add value to you through your voices. If there are any topics that you'd like me to pick up, please let me know in the comment section as well. I'd love to start chatting with you. And if you'd like to continue listening to the show, please subscribe. Thank you.